Welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders. Today, we're very excited to have with us Cecilia Tan, who is the CEO of Sasia REIT. Welcome, Cecilia, to today's episode.
Thank you, Daphne, for having me.
Let's kick off the episode by understanding a little bit more about what led you to become the CEO of Sasia REIT today.
Okay, it's a long story, but just to cut it short, I had the opportunity to get to know my chairman of the platform, who is also, you know, the chairman of the sponsor, way back in 2016, through a mutual introduction by some friends in the industry. And, you know, when we met, he was actually in Singapore, at that time exploring a listing of Sasia REIT. And then we clicked very well because, he doesn't really speak much English.
Okay.
And I, you know, one of the few is I speak quite good Mandarin. So, you know, I think that helps to sort of build bridges in terms of communication. And I was also very fascinated by what he was trying to do here, bringing sort of outlet mall listing. And then subsequently we sort of kept in touch. And in 2019, he actually, when I left my old corporate job, he actually mooted the idea that maybe I should come and sort of provide some strategic support to him, because at that time, the REIT just got listed, and he was also very interested to understand, see how stock market operate. And, you know, this is like the first international, I would say offshore, venture they have in form of listing. So I did that for him as a part-time, advisor to him for about 2 years. And then in between, I think, I get to know him a lot better as a, you know, really at personal range, and also got to know some of his colleagues back in China. And I got so comfortable with, you know, who they are, what they do in China. And in 2021, there was some discussions around CEO succession. And I thought, okay, probably it's time to really take the plunge. And there I am.
And maybe for our audience who might not be so familiar, could you share a little bit more about what Sasia REIT does?
Yeah. So Sasia REIT was actually listed in March 2018. It's sort of a very interesting REIT. It's the first, I would say, Asia outlet mall REIT. So it's in a retail space, but it is a very specialized space. This is outlet mall. I think most of us are not unfamiliar with outlet mall. But I think before the Sasia REIT listing, actually a lot of people didn't realize that it's actually a very vibrant and growing industry in China in relation to outlet malls, you know, the industry. And when I sort of got into this job, I researched a little bit more. Actually, the outlet mall industry in China started in 2002.
Oh.
Actually, the same time as the Singapore REIT industry started. Okay, so quite uncanny. So when we got listed here, I think one of those things we also try to educate the market here is, you know, that is a very specialized retail format in China. And in fact, that caters to a very specialized, what I call the middle class consumers. And I always tell the market and my investors that if you want consumption proxy, you know, you should be looking at Sasia REIT.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. And you know, earlier you mentioned that you joined Sasia REIT in 2021, and that's in the middle of the pandemic.
Yes.
What were some of the challenges that you faced, especially given, you know, all the travel restrictions and then you're based here in Singapore?
Yeah, indeed. I think when I came aboard, a few components there in terms of restriction. I remember the transition was really work from home entirely. I mean, in my whole life, I've never worked from home. So I think it was in that era that everybody, you know, sort of got around and understanding what work from home means. So when I transitioned into the role, in fact, every day I was just on Zoom with my colleagues. And you're right. I think for the REIT, right, the main assets are the properties. And because the properties are all in China, you know, in fact, before I came on, I joined in July 2021.
Yeah.
So before I came on, actually, my chairman's side, China, they were discussing whether I should go to China. But it was difficult because they had long quarantines.
Correct.
You know, they have like 14 plus 7 depending. So, you know, after a few rounds of discussion, we sort of aborted the idea.
Yeah.
So I told them, let me just transit here in the Singapore office and then, you know, we see how it goes. Yeah. And of course, 2021, you know, that whole transition was, I wouldn't say very difficult, but still, because, you know, I'm coming into a role which is full time and in a sort of critical leadership position.
Yeah, exactly.
I literally was trying to sort of get things done virtually. So you can imagine it's actually quite challenging.
Yes.
But I think, you know, with all things, we always find ways to get around it.
Yeah. And what are some of the, you know, primary responsibilities and challenges of managing a REIT here in Singapore with properties in a different country?
Yeah. I think the first thing first is when a REIT has 100% of assets overseas, the biggest challenge you have is a lot of the people, they don't have affinity with the assets because, you know, they can't go to the asset and, you know, asset and particularly property, right? Mm. I find sometimes can be very emotive. Mm. And people, you know, like whether they like the look and feel of it, the location. So one of those things we try to bridge the gap is that we try to sort of showcase a lot of the outlets via videos.
Right.
And one of those things, good things that my sponsor team in China, they are like very extremely media savvy. I think I'm like so glad that, you know, because we have so much contents, we are not, we have no lack of contents. Mm-hmm. But I think that cannot still totally replace the what we call the experiential component in terms of people going to see the outlet. So obviously, China just only recently opened up, right, in July, visa free. So the first thing we did this year, and if for those who follow us on LinkedIn, you know, we brought a bunch of analysts to the outlets. And they were like totally, totally wow. Because in as much as they see the videos, they already got so excited. Mm. But it's very different when you go and see the real thing because you feel the mood there. And you can feel that is the market there is so different from Singapore. Mm. The outlets in terms of scale is, you know, on average, every outlet is about the size of VivoCity. That is like small for your knowledge. So everything in China has to be proportionate to what we understand of the Singapore market.
Right,
outlet itself, at least the one that we run our outlets, we have a very unique proposition in terms of even the hardware itself, the look and feel, right? It's very different from what you see from a Japanese outlet, from a US or Australia outlet. And those, what I would call the open style village, the outlets that we have in China, at least under Cesar, is really just mega shopping center.
So as it is,
people already don't connect that. But the moment they step into the outlet, they feel that they know it's an outlet because everywhere, right, there's so much discounts and so much shopping available. And I remember the analysts, like they were like, just keep nonstop buying. So, you know? So clearly that sort of like, it's a big catalyst for people wanting to shop and feel and touch the elements there.
Yeah, and it must be very exciting for you to be operating a REIT like that. What keeps you, you know, most excited on a day-to-day basis?
I think is to expect the unexpected and to look forward the surprise and upside. Yeah, because very interesting in terms of our REIT model, right?
Yeah.
The underlying leases, and again, this is so peculiar. I think probably works well in a market like China where they have a huge population base. A lot of the leases in the outlets are actually, they don't pay fixed rent.
That's
right. Your expression already tell me. Because it's unthinkable, right? For a landlord that you have a tenant that you don't pay you a fixed rent, you get worried. But because this is very contrary to how a landlord would be wanting to get predictable cash flows. This has worked very well because of the fact that the nature of the outlet, right, is really we try to drive sales. And one of those things we are also looking at is how do we rejuvenate the outlet through the kind of tenants and the brands we bring in. Now imagine that, you know, I mean, if you, case in point, if you go to our shopping centers in Singapore, you find that they are quite same more. So it's so boring. But in outlets, what we thrive on is that when we look at the performance of the tenants, how do we have alignment of interest? So the model that's worked very well is we take a percentage of their sales. Which means it's a double-edged sword. If the tenants performs very well, which means, you know, then we pick the right brands.
Right.
And then we know we get a higher percentage in coming back to rental.
Yes.
But if the tenant doesn't perform well, then, you know, we will be thinking about how do we get rid of the tenants. As part of this package, right, we sign very short leases with the tenants. We sign, you know, maybe between 1 to 2 years. And in fact, some of the new tenants that come in, we test bait, they could even sign like 6 months. And then we do an extension. This is very, very different from how retail operate here. Retail tends to sign longer leases. They want stability, they want certainty, but we want flexibility. So it's very interesting whenever we have a new tenants coming in, I'm always looking forward to how the tenant is going to perform. And we actually look at tenancy in a very holistic manner because of the fact that, you know, no one tenant is providing that huge concentration of income. So that's something that we always are very sort of mindful. And that will also ensure stability of the cash flows, that the cash flows will not be dependent on any one or two tenants.
Yeah. And also quite interesting, you mentioned that the leases are short. I'm curious when the tenants are being refreshed also and on a kind of like 6 months or 1 year basis, does that keep the consumers or the shoppers also excited to come back to see what's
in fact, I tell you, it keeps the retailers on their toes, right? Because if they don't perform well, they may lose a chance to be in our outlets, and we have a long waiting list.
Okay.
But having said that, so even when we sign short leases, we tend to have a high retention rate, so we just keep renewing their leases.
Nice.
Yeah, and in fact, we are seeing some of the tenants over the years that perform so well, they've increased their spaces in our outlets. So in some of the outlets, they have double story, duplex.
Wow.
Yeah. So double floors of shopping. Now in Singapore, who gets that? Only the high-end brands like Louis Vuitton. No. No. In our outlets, right, the sports brand were doing very well. Some they have double floors.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, under your very strong leadership and also based on what you have mentioned, I would like to congratulate you on a really strong first half of the year performance. Maybe you could share with us what led to such strong performance, especially this was before China's reopening. How did that pan out? Yeah.
I think if we sort of put in perspective, 2022 was extremely challenging for us. I think 2022, globally, nobody expected China to go through such a roller coaster ride in COVID. And when I look at the numbers, right, in 2022, in fact, our four outlets in China, two in Chongqing, one in Hefei, one in Kunming, in total year, we have to close because of COVID restrictions for close to 2 months.
Wow.
Yeah. So coming into 2023, of course, the relaxation in COVID, remember, happened very late in December 2022. Mm. It was like fast and furious and caught everybody by surprise. But that to us was such a great relief, because the biggest challenge when managing our outlets during COVID was the unpredictability. We were literally on the toes here in Singapore I was most concerned about the health and the mental health of my colleagues in China, because they were going through so much stress.
Yeah.
And, and also about, preserving their health environment for our shoppers, because we really don't want to have any infectious situation. And thank God that, actually that was very well controlled. So coming into 2023, of course, the great opening story of China, right? Everybody was so anticipating. I mean, we had a good first quarter. Mm-hmm. To be honest, second quarter came in a little bit softer, but all in, I think first half still performed very well. First half, our sales for the four outlets in total was 2.3 billion renminbi.
Wow, congrats.
2.3 billion renminbi, just to put in context, Singapore is about 450 million Sing, right? And that was 20.5% year on year. Wow. But of course, 2022 was a low base, but still, that shows that, when there's a reopening, people want to go back to physical shopping.
Correct.
Right. So I was always asked this question. Don't you think the e-commerce will disrupt? But I think the numbers speak for themselves. there is this great desire that people want to go back for experiential shopping. And that's always how we position our outlets. And in fact, during that period first, our occupancy actually reached a record high of 97.2, even before pre-COVID of 96%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So our numbers actually exceeded pre-COVID. So I think it tells you a lot about really, firstly, I feel that we have established ourselves as a very good brand name in the outlet space. Our sponsor group, they are the number one operator in China in terms of the number of outlets in China. So clearly they are a household name in some of the cities that they are in. Two, I think there is this great desire that people want to go out and spend. Retail therapy is very real, Because I do that from time to time, right? So, you feel good spending money, more so when you buy discounted brand goods at discounted prices, right? You're feeling that, you get a good deal.
That's amazing. And I mean, looking ahead, what are some of the key trends that you have observed in the space? I think earlier you mentioned quite a number of people asking you about e-commerce disrupting the area. But personally, what are some of the key trends that you think would continue to pan out in the next 2 to 3 years?
I think definitely COVID has brought about a disruption across sectors, and retail has also, and then we've seen that in ourselves, right? Robinson's, right? 160-year-old retail departmental store closed shop finally.
Yeah.
Totally. I was so devastated, because that was one of my favorite departmental stores to go to. But by the same token, recently, I think not too long ago, there is this big departmental store called Pacific Taiping Yang. It's a Taiwanese departmental store. They also been in China for 30 years. They finally closed their last shop in Xu Jia Hui in Shanghai.
Okay.
Right. A big departmental store. So I think what is happening now is that if your retail format, you don't have a clear value proposition. Mm. Now, departmental store clearly is in direct competition with the e-commerce. Yeah. Because if you go to departmental store, it's like general merchandise. Mm. And people get that online already.
Yeah.
Right? So for us, how do we continue to be at the forefront of the retail format? Mm-hmm. One of those things that we actually spend a lot of time on is Kefu, which is customer service.
Oh, okay.
Customer service is very big because these days, apart from people wanting to just buy goods, they want to be educated when they go to a shop. They want to understand the product. And I think that customer service is that touch point.
Yes.
That will bring the customer back again to the stores.
Yeah.
So that's number one. The other two is that we always make sure that we have variety.
Okay.
So this is part that I feel that we can compete with the e-commerce. Because the e-commerce, one of those things is convenience and variety. But yes, in outlets, right? At least in our outlets, we have something like 300 to 500 brands.
Wow.
Yeah. So literally you can spend one whole day in the outlets and then you must be thinking you're coming back again because you probably not go be able to go to every single shop.
Yes, right.
So we try to do that in order to sort of like also added that human touch element, that choice, but also very important for us in the outlet, we give the clear value proposition of discounted prices.
Okay.
Now, people, more so now in China, where we call 消费降级, there's a downgrade in consumption. We see that value proposition being a lot more of a catalyst now,
right,
where people are really clearly looking to buy goods and they feel that, oh, they're getting a good deal.
Yes.
In the past, when people are a lot more liberal with their spending, right, they may not really want to think about such things, but it's becoming a lot more important now for a lot of our consumers.
Yeah. And you know, riding on these trends that you have mentioned, then how do you capitalize on them going forward?
Yeah. So I think we must know our weakness and strength.
Mm.
Okay. So for our group, we are very cognizant of our strength and we continue to invest in what we do and continue to do very well in those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of those things we also have been spending and harnessing is what we call the VIP customer base.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, our VIP customer base is quite unlike the loyalty program we have here. Okay. Sorry to say. I think the loyalty program we have here are quite primitive. Okay. But, you know, the VIP, we really treat them like really red carpet treatment. For example, in our Liangjiang shop, if you go to our website, you will see we have a dedicated space called VIP Lounge.
Okay.
And they can go and, you know, they can use the facilities there. They can sit down, have a chat. They can even book some of the private rooms. They can order food in.
Yeah.
You know, we really want to sort of make them feel at home.
Yeah.
Okay. All this, right, is about increasing the stickiness of them coming. And I think in China also, a lot of people pay attention to a lot of branding association.
Yeah.
So we want them to feel that, oh, they feel very proud that they are Sao Zhi Chuan VIP customer, right? And then they get really all this good deals. And when we have like promotional activities, the VIP will get to invited first and they will come first bite of the cherry.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
In fact, one of those things we do quite interestingly is that when we run our September anniversary sales at Zhong Nian Ti, which is a signature, the VIP will be first to come and it's 24-hour shopping.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so unimaginable.
Yeah, I know. And so they will be looking so forward to it because it's such an experience that you shop in the mall like 2, 3 a.m., you know, thousands of people are still shopping with you in the mall. You know, the kind of feeling is I think is very
it's very special.
Yeah, it's very special,
yes,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So it's one of those things that we do. The other things, of course, we continue to harness brand relationships.
Mm.
Because that is really the lifeline. For us, outlet to be successful is we need to continue to have that brands and then have that conversation with the brand to make sure that their inventory stays up to date. And in fact, increasingly, like some of the sportsmen are doing very well, we have direct factory outlet line.
Oh.
Now, what does that mean? It means that we cut away all the intermediaries.
Right.
We provide even greater price point competitiveness to our consumers.
Yes.
Yeah. So those are the things that as a group, they continue to harness and put resources. So it's really managing a lot of those relationships.
Correct. It's less transactional in a sense.
Correct.
Yeah. And Sachin Ray also has portfolio, I mean, the properties are around different parts or different regions in China.
Yes.
Maybe you could share a bit more of the differences that you have noticed across the retail industry in different regions in China.
Okay, China is really big. Right? Yes. I mean, and we are mainly in the tier 2, tier 3 cities. So I get this question a lot when, oh, China reopening, does that mean that everybody will rush out of China? And then how that impact? Okay, I think, you know, really the late, the ordinary folks in China in tier 2, tier 3 cities, they actually don't travel that much. Right? So because of this, there is this huge desire to still domestic consumption spending.
Yeah.
You see more of that in tier 1, tier 2, tier 1 cities. So Sesa Group, by the fact that we started in tier 2, tier 3 cities, we understand the dynamics of that consumer behavior very well.
Yeah.
Okay. But obviously, when we go to different cities, we also try to tune the sort of mix a little bit, depending on the consumption habits and capacity. For example, in Nanjing, right? Yeah. Nanjing is not in our portfolio, but Nanjing is managed by our sponsor. Nanjing is a high consumption, the high capacity for consumption spending.
Yeah.
So they started with one outlet. Now they have another one in Nanjing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I think we look at where the trends are and we go to where we feel that we are going to cater to an underserved market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where people, you know, wants to buy discounted branded goods at a discount, but they don't have the means. And, you know, it's actually not easy to open an outlet. So what has happened is over the years, what the group, the sponsor has done, has gone what we call the asset-light strategy.
Okay.
Now, because if you do the traditional model, you go and bid a piece of land, you go and do a construction, that will easily take you maybe 3 to 4 years
from
planning to, you know, built, and also that requires a lot of capital. That model in today's market is, number one, is very capital intensive. Two, given where the property crisis is in China, you really don't want to get involved in all this. So the group, actually, I would say they have huge foresight. Particularly my chairman, he understood you know, how do you penetrate yourself in this retail market, right? What he has done now, apart from the early outlets that he built and four of which already injected in Sesame, he has gone to, say, third-party property owners, and he said 20 years master lease.
Oh.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe he was be looking at places where he will feel that he's not represented there, but there is latent or potential consumption spending gap that can be unlocked.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like this. Is if you don't bring a product, you cannot unlock the consumption. So, right. So he will do that, and then he will maybe put some capex, and sometimes the landlord could also agree to put some capex, and then they will do renovation depending on extent, and boom, you become a outlet already.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we just opened one in Shijiazhuang on the 28th of September.
Nice.
To huge fanfare.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is how we are looking at in terms of penetrating different parts of China, but part of that is also increasing the brand equity.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I now want to turn back time a bit. You started out your career as an investment banker at JP Morgan, listing REITs across your journey, and then now you're managing one. How did that experience kind of build up to what you're doing today?
Yeah, I think when you're a banker, you are very transactional in nature because you do one project to the other. So when I listed when I was a banker, I listed Ascender Suite, and that was very, very early days. And that was a very interesting journey because clearly Ascenders at that time, they were looking at all the industrial properties. So you look at the properties. So one of those things that is a discipline, because the REIT got to look at income producing assets. Now, you don't just pick any income producing assets. You need to pick those assets that, you know, have the fundamentals to sustain a level of stable income. So we actually have to go through a whole lot of feasibility study in terms of picking the really good ones to try to come into the REIT.
Right.
Now, but when I was a banker, I was just doing, I would say, the beginning of the thing, helping my client put together.
Yeah.
But I didn't get around to managing. Right? So there's a Chinese saying, 创业容易,可是守业更难. Right? So I think the more difficult part is the managing of the REIT.
Yes.
But I think because of the fact that I started in a journey, I understood what it takes to do, so put together a REIT. It helps me now becoming an inside practitioner. When I look at the REIT, what are things that sort of need to drive the sustainability and the resilience of the REIT for that? Because REIT is supposed to be very long-term. Real estates are supposed to be very long-term vehicles. When we do strategies, we need to think about, we cannot be so short-term, but how do we build every dollar that we invest must create long-term effect, but maybe it may not be immediately recoverable in terms of results, but clearly that will help to maybe even sustain the valuation of the assets in the long term.
Yeah. And also kind of like, if you reflect back on your journey, what are some of the key learnings that you have had that you continue to apply as you think about managing the REIT today?
Okay, because the REIT is a listed vehicle, right? So the REIT is, I would say when we look at the REIT, is although the underlying assets are real estate, but the REIT fundamentally is a financial product.
Yeah.
Okay, so the good thing is that when I was a banker, you know, I did a lot of capital markets transaction.
Yeah.
So when I'm managing the REIT, I got to be very cognizant about the capital markets environment. Mm. Because you cannot say that you just ignore what's happening in the macro, right? And a lot of this, like, you know, investor sentiment is very key. So you have a situation whereby you may be thinking, oh, your results are so good. Like, for example, our results are very good. Then why is our share price keep going down? Right? Because, you know, that is also a function of the capital markets. And so we have to be very cognizant in terms of how we align and also sort of not go against the trends of the capital market, but also stand ready to capture the trends of the capital markets when we see the tide turning in our favor.
Right.
So, and the other thing, of course, in managing the REIT, the capital structure is very important. Mm. The cost of capital, REITs is very sensitive, which is why you see now in the high interest rate environment, right? All the share prices of the REIT all tumble because of the fact that the REIT actually has a borrowing and high interest rate definitely is going to be negative in terms of the cost structure for the REIT.
Mm.
So that's something that, you know, given my banking background, I am a lot more attuned to this sort of elements.
Correct. And speaking of capital structures, previously you also had led multiple transactions across different countries, Singapore, UK, China. And as you reflect on these transactions that you have done, what are some of the key factors that leads to successful closure of these transactions, especially in when it comes to cross-border deals that people might be handling?
Maybe to narrow that down, I would talk a little bit more about the property transactions. I've done property transactions across many countries. Mm. And one of those things, when we look at property transactions, there are some similarities across all countries, but there are also differences. For example, if you go to UK, the transaction that I did was a heritage building.
Okay.
So it's what they call a listed property. So when we're buying that transaction, the due diligence angle is different.
Mm.
We have to be very sensitive about, because the client wanted to do a lot of renovation, and then we need to go and really look at the structure and see where are the parts that we can start to tune and not tune. And we need to have the conversations with the regulators, because so in every transaction, we have to look at where the deal breaking point, maybe relative to apart from the price, the transaction itself might have some deal breaking elements, and we have to be very cognizant of that. Then, of course, it's culture. We cannot say we do things like this in Singapore, and then when I go and do a transaction in Indonesia or Malaysia or UK, I'm going to adopt. So when we go there, I normally work, at least those times, I work with the local team, and we try to sort of customize the approach that we do. Because at the end of the day, right, very simply, bankers are there to provide solutions. Okay. Now, the transaction is the outcome of how you navigate through those hurdles and challenges.
Yes.
And those could be, some of which could be very technical, but some of which actually you require some human navigation in terms of how you communicate, how you package, how you, you know, reach out to different stakeholders in the whole system. So I enjoyed that a lot.
What was your most memorable transaction that you have completed?
There was one in Singapore. That was in very, very early days when I was still a junior banker. It was actually a hotel in a premium park in Singapore. Mm. It's called ANA Hotel. You're probably too young to remember that. Okay. But in those days, a lot of the Japanese airlines, they love to buy hotels because it's like they provide end-to-end solutions. But interestingly, their hotel is actually part of a listed company, and it's a single asset. So I remember after the Asian financial crisis, one of the major airlines in Japan approached us to try to get us to sell this listed company in Singapore. But you can imagine the environment was very tough. So so I was put on that job as the main banker. And, you know, I was still trying to figure out how to do real estate transactions because I was quite a junior banker. So when I look at that, it was a hotel. But, you know, hotel actually was very tough to sell because, you know, hotel by nature is very unpredictable. But, you know, Singapore is a very interesting thing. They have this thing called change of use. So halfway through the transaction, we realized actually the hotel can be rezoned as residential.
Oh.
Yeah. So then we decided, okay, we're going to pitch it very differently. Mm. We're not going to sell the hotel as it is.
Yeah.
We're going to sell the hotel with the rest, with the redevelopment angle.
Mm.
You know, then we try to sell at a higher NAV. And that was how we actually re-engineered and redesigned. And eventually that transaction was completed at a higher transaction volume. And of course, our fees also better. So that was a very, very memorable. The other thing is very interesting because halfway through, right? When we first started as a hotel, I couldn't get any traction. And I told my Japanese client, yeah, you wait for one more year. And my boss is saying that I'm a crazy woman. I couldn't tell Japanese client to wait for one more year because I truly believe, right? You don't go against the market because the market is not ready. And so the client was surprisingly listened to my advice. 1 year later, when we restarted, right? The change of zone came in. And that's how we managed to pivot that and became a residential. And today, if you go and see the site, it's built a high-end residential.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, so that to me was very, very interesting because it also shows the actual real estate, right? It's not, you cannot see real estate just pure brick and mortar.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, real estate also has a financial angle.
Yes.
How do you unlock?
Correct.
How do you unlock real estate? So it's the same when I manage to read, right? How do I continue to unlock value?
Exactly. I was going to say this, what you have just shared kind of pans through your entire career.
Yeah.
And also earlier you had also alluded to when you're currently managing the REIT, thinking very actively about, you know, not just that very standard playbook model of how to manage REITs, retail or outlets should actually operate, but really thinking very creatively so that you can unlock value across different angles.
Yes.
And I find that very exciting. Maybe last question for the English segment. You know, this transaction that you have just shared was at an earlier point in your career. What advice would you have for younger professionals who are thinking about exploring a career in real estate investments? How should you go about thinking about that?
Okay, I think real estate investments, okay, when I tell people I do real estate, people say, oh, you're property agent. You know, that is like the first thing to come.
Yeah.
But actually, real estate in the very high end, what you call the institutional platform, right, is really about financial returns.
Mm.
Okay, so when we look at the real estate, we also, okay, one of those things is you have to be grounded in a lot of fundamentals, the legal side of things, okay, the tax side of things. Okay, when you do a real estate transaction in, say, in China, versus in Singapore, a lot of that, how you unlock the returns has to do with how you put the capital for the real estate, how you structure the real estate, right? Because there'll be tax implications, there'll be legal, and also when you do due diligence on the real estate, when you encounter problems, okay, when you buy a real estate, when you go into, say, a purchase agreement, how do you mitigate the risk?
Yeah.
So a lot of that, right, requires very fundamental grounding in terms of understanding the risk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a lot of people have this tendency, oh, right, real estate, I just look at the blue sky. From my own training, right, when I look into real estate, the first thing I try to look at are the risk.
Mm.
Okay. Can I undertake certain measures to de-risk?
Mm.
Right. I mean, if it's a physical means, I just put capex. But if it's structural, it could be latent risk. How do I de-risk? Like in the S&P, can I pass that risk to the seller? Okay. Can I buy insurance?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think there's actually a whole lot of creativity solutions that you can do. In fact, I did a transaction in China.
Mm.
Just sort of sidetrack, just to give the point. In Xintiandi.
Okay.
Yeah, that was in 2004.
Okay.
Okay, I was managing income fund. But Xintiandi at that point in time, when we went to do Xintiandi, it was a development project. How do I reconcile?
Yeah.
We did a structure of a convertible bond.
Mm.
Okay, so it can be done.
Yeah.
Okay, but it requires you to really think out of the box.
And
work towards a solution that will meet the finance. At the end, it's all about financial returns. Yeah.
And I think with that, we wrap up the English segment of today's episode. Now we'll move on to the Chinese rapid fire questions. Now, 其实呢，我们现在就进入快问快答的环节。那你准备好了吗？可以啊，我就随性吧。那首先，能不能够用中文介绍一下自己？
好啊，我是道道地地的新加坡姑娘，我姓陈，我的中文名字叫凤来，可能就是我的父母是望子成龙，望女成凤吧，刚好的名字属于凤来，对对对，那么我家庭呢就蛮简单的，就是一个老公，一个儿子，这样子。
那你最喜欢的中国城市是哪一个呢？
这个问题其实我有思考过。其实我最早期去中国的时候是在95年，我当时去了北京哦。我当时去了北京，其实我就感觉哇，好落后哦，因为北京当时就是其实没有很多的高楼，
是。
那么我当时下榻的那个酒店是他们说的国企酒店啊，所以我进去我就感觉哇，有点担心那个卫生的情况好像不是很好。可是十年过后，我再回返到中国，当时我去了上海啊，04年去做了新天地内中那个项目，我非常的震撼。我抵达中国，我一路那个车。从机场沿路到就是淮海路那段路啊，我看到的中国是我几乎是没有想象到，就非常的时尚。而且它的高楼的那个设计，我当时觉得比新加坡还要就是大胆，还要创新。
是，
所以我感觉到当时中国的潜力非常的庞大。当然我陆陆续续呢也去了几个城市啊，不过上来管理这个沙之船房多之后呢，我也去了重庆跟昆明，
是
还有合肥，
对，
我可以说是每个城市有它的一个吸引力吧。但是我最熟悉的城市还是上海，因为我毕竟当时在做新天地那个案子，我在上海陆陆续续待了几个月，
哇，
所以其实我那个时候呢，就是会走去外滩，那个南京的步道行那个地方我都非常熟悉的，而且当时就是来福士城刚刚在那边开始，开业嘛，可是我现在去了重庆跟昆明，诶，其实我觉得重庆跟昆明也是非常吸引我的。昆明呢有它的少数民族，所以它，我觉得中国它，你到每个城市，你第一个要尝试它的美食。
OK，
你最接触的那个城市就是通过吃，
是
吃的饮食文化在我们华人是非常重要的。
对，
通过吃你去了解这个当地的一个城市，它的历史，从它的吃它的食物其实反映出它的历史。当时我去了昆明，它的少数民族吃那个手抓饭啦，还有那个昆菌啊，对吗？那个菌锅，我就觉得哇，这个东西非常的有趣。
对，
那么我到了重庆，当然是吃的重庆火锅，对吗？那么在上海又吃不一样的，就是那些不一样的食材，所以我觉得每个中国城市我都挺喜欢的。
好，那说到美食，那你最喜欢的中国美食会是哪一个呢？
我对辣还是不太行哦，所以其实这个重庆火锅对我来说还是蛮有挑战的。当然，重庆火锅它的那个鲜度是非常好，特别是它的那个要是它的食材是非常新鲜，
是
你这个火锅我觉得是非常健康，可是那个麻有点受不了。
对，
所以我还是偏向比较就是小笼包这类的一些。我们比较在新加坡比较熟悉的，
是是是是，
比如说粤菜啦，
对吗？
还有潮州菜，我就很喜欢。
OK OK OK， 那就是很多我们的观众应该不知道，你之前是以中文教了房地产这个课程，那你是为什么决定这么做呢？
其实我教那个才几天的时间呢。
OK OK，
所以其实我那个是受邀去教课，那么我觉得还蛮新鲜的，因为我从来没有尝试过，就是以中文来解说嘛，
是，
所以当时还是蛮有压力的，还是要经过一段的学习，因为这个语言要是你没有每天去用了，其实它没有产生一个自然反应，
是
要发自内心的，
对，
所以可能我这个接触之后呢，感觉是比较有自信吧，
是。那你就是在英文的播客的时候也提到了，就是因为你的中文能力非常强，所以遇到就是沙之船的主席的时候，就能够培养一些一定的默契，
是。
那你是怎么样把你的中文培养到这么好的程度呢？
我觉得跟我的家庭背景很有关系，因为我的父母其实他们教育程度很低的，其实我从小在家是讲福建话的讲福建话的，因为我们那个年代的父母一般都没有受很大的教育，
是，
所以英文其实不行，所以可能而且我的父亲他即便说他教育程度不是很高，可是很喜欢买中文书，所以我家里一大堆的中文书你知道吗？所以有时候呢你就会不经意的你就会拿出来读，
是，
所以我觉得就是从小对这个语言呢就是产生非常熟悉，你没有抗拒，不像我觉得现在的小孩子都有这个问题，他对这个中文他非常的抗拒，
是，
所以我们是在这种环境下呢，而且我从小呢就是听广播长大，而且呢我也只看中文播导，因为我的父母他都 不会英文嘛，所以他只能看中文播道，所以我是在那样的环境下长大的。其实我老实说，我去学校的时候，我的英文很差的，每次那个英文考试我就好害怕，因为我就觉得好像我会不及格，
看不出。
对对对
，OK OK， 那这个最后一道问题就是，您对于中国零售业的这个领域的机遇会有什么样的看法呢？
我觉得中国的消费群呢，它是非常的犀利的。因为特别是这种中国零售，它是一个竞争很强大的。
是。
比如说我们杀猪船自己本身，为什么我们这么多年来还是有这个领导的一个地位？我觉得这个当中呢，也是要很清楚的，能够很清楚的抓到消费者他的投其所好吧。因为在这种不断演变的一个过程，比如说这个电商，它的对这个零售的冲击是非常庞大的。
对
啊，我特别是看到疫情的时候啊，所有的实体店你都不能够营业的时候，只有电商它是冠军，因为它只有在它这边是赚钱的。
对
啊，可是这个疫情后时代，为什么实体店呢？它还是有这个存在的能力？我觉得这当中呢，也是表示说这个人啊，他还是一个。要到一个实体店，他要能够触摸，他也能够体验的。可是这当中呢，我刚才有提到，就是这个太平洋百货，他在30年啊，在上海那个店，老店呢、啊，根据我的理解，30年不变，30年不变这个道理哦，你认为他你是最好的，可是消费者他是会转变的。
对，
所以你在这种情况下，你还是保持不变，而消费者已经转变，
是
你自然会没落，所以他自然就被淘汰了。所以我们在这个零售业呢，我们一直要求新，
是
求变。所以其实我们集团有一个号召，就是一直要在创新。我们的创新可以很细腻的，
对，
可以很细腻。比如说在客服方面呢，我一直不断的去寻找创新，
是
怎么去接触客人，这个是一个很深奥的功课。
对。
那么你在这个板块你做得很好的时候，你的客人的心已经交到你身上来的时候。真的，你的那些竞争者，你要抓住你这个客人的心，我觉得是有难度的。所以我们在这方面呢，是求清除突破，而且呢，在比如说在整个品牌的一个布局呢，我们是往上攀的。我记得我们家的主席他说过一句话，你要把奥莱，就是奥特莱斯，就是奥乐的简称，做得非常时尚啊。他用了这个观念，你怎么去解释啊？理解这个观念，就是说你不要把奥莱变成说它是个非常低档的一个行业。我们这个当中在创新的过程中呢，我们要把奥莱的整个一个级别拉高，所以客人来到你的奥莱，他觉得他是very high level， 不是 low level 那种，就是捡这种最便宜的，
对，
烂货那种，不是的。我们要把它这个奥莱的定位拉到时尚，我们才能够跟着时代走，因为现在客人的要求越来越高了。
对，那这样我们就结束今天的播客呢，非常感谢Cecilia， 就是百忙之中抽空和我们分享你对房地产信托的经验那。Thank you so much, Cecilia, for spending time with us today to share with us your experience in listing and managing REITs. I personally learned a lot and also see the spark in your eyes when you're describing, you know, how excited you are in growing Cecilia, and wishing Cecilia all the best all the success.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Business Beyond Borders. If you have any feedback or thoughts, do write in to us at support@bluen.com. Click to follow to tune into the next episode. See you again soon!